listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Hospitals around Wisconsin that are already near capacity with COVID-19 patients are taking extreme steps to prepare for a continued surge of new cases and new hospitalizations. In just a few minutes, we'll talk to the president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. First, in the state's northwestern region, Rich Kramer reports that the Mayo Clinic Health System is adding beds and out-of-state staff.
On a cold November night outside the Mayo Clinic Health System's Eau Claire Hospital, things look pretty normal. If anything, the parking lot seems a bit empty, while the occasional ambulance pulls up to the back of the hospital's emergency department. In this case, looks are deceiving, because inside, staff are taking unprecedented steps to make room for more patients suffering with COVID-19, 2 weeks after Mayo announced all of its beds in northwestern Wisconsin were full.
Our surge plan expands into the garage, it opens up more beds. We're expanding into lobbies. We're putting people where we wouldn't normally put patients.
That's emergency room doctor Sue Cullinan recording a video diary entry October 12th. In another entry, she's checking out space in the heated ambulance garage where Mayo has since set up 4 hospital beds.
Not where I'd want to put my grandfather or my grandmother. It may have to happen.
Dr. Paul Horvath is another ER physician with Mayo. During a recent shift, regional hospitals ran out of space for new patients.
And literally every bed in northwest Wisconsin was full, and hospitals just weren't able to admit new patients, which means that I had the challenge of managing ICU-level care in my ER for hours, which is obviously not routine.
When emergency rooms fill up, Horvath says paramedics have to find new places to bring patients that are further away and may not have the same level of staff or equipment to treat the critically ill. Once in the ER, Horvath says it's hard to comfort scared patients through layers of protective equipment. It's also harder to coordinate care.
It's oftentimes difficult to communicate between the care team that are in the room as we're doing tasks with monitors beeping and staff yelling to try to talk above the monitor and through the physical barriers in front of our faces.
Mike Davis of Eau Claire has seen the hospital's transformation as a staffer and a patient. The self-described husky farm boy from northern Wisconsin began feeling worn down in late August, but the seriousness of his illness wasn't clear until he was watching the Packers-Vikings game September 13th.
I don't remember any of this. My wife tells me when I wasn't watching the Packer game, I went to the bathroom and my lips were blue. But then she took me to the emergency room and I was intubated. They took fluid from my lungs and the fluid from my lungs tested positive for COVID right away.
Davis had worked at the hospital for 20 years imaging hearts and was now being treated by longtime colleagues and friends who kept him alive despite having respiratory failure twice.
You know, I was systemically starting to succumb to it because my lungs were so full of fluid. I had such bad COVID pneumonia that I was dying, essentially. But my heart kept me going.
The deluge of COVID-19 patients is taking an emotional toll on healthcare workers, picking up extra shifts and tending to patients who cannot see their loved ones. Mayo Chief Nursing Officer for Northwestern Wisconsin, Pam White, recalled a nurse helping a man about to be intubated call his wife, not knowing whether he would see her again.
It's happening every day. We have families dying in the hospital. It's really hard from a healthcare perspective because people can drive by the hospital and it looks normal. The walls don't look any different outside the hospital. It's everything that's happening inside the hospital that is really quite challenging, and it's hard to appreciate until you've actually experienced it.
Wisconsin Hospital Association Director Eric Borgeting says while hospitals may be able to create more beds for new patients, the biggest challenge is staffing them.
We have hundreds, if not thousands, of healthcare workers out right now because they've had some sort of an exposure in the community.
Borgeting hopes to see significant bipartisan action from state lawmakers and Governor Tony Evers to support hospitals working to recruit more staff. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, the Wisconsin Hospital Association is calling on Governor Evers and legislative leaders to work together to limit the spread of COVID-19 infections. In a letter last week, it said healthcare workers are feeling burned out from long hours and emotional stress, and without meaningful, swift, and unified action to address the problem, the healthcare crisis will turn into catastrophe. The State Department of Health Services reported no new deaths yesterday for the first time in more than a month, but more than 1,000 people have died over the last 30 days. The Hospital Association says just shy of 2,000 patients are in the hospital today, slightly down from a peak of about 2,300 a week ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a healthcare worker on the front lines of COVID-19? Tell us about your experiences and how you're feeling about the virus's spread. Have you or someone you know been hospitalized with COVID? And what would you like to see elected leaders do about the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Borgerding is president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
What did you call from Governor Evers, from legislative leaders that could help deal with this rush of COVID-19 patients into the state's hospitals?
Well, first and foremost, we are urgently calling on our elected leaders to come together around some common ground. And there's several areas where we think and hope that could take place, but it really falls into two buckets. One is slowing the spread of COVID, because that is truly the root cause of everything your listeners just heard in those previous stories. And second of all, coming together around strategies and resources to expand the capacity of the healthcare system to sustain and expand the capacity of our healthcare system to address the really surging demand for patient care. And by the way, not just demand for patient care related to COVID, but it is important that Wisconsin, to the greatest extent possible, maintain, that our healthcare system maintain capacity for non-COVID patients as well. COVID is crowding out, if you will, the ability of our healthcare system to provide that very important care for some non-COVID, you know, non-emergency, but non-COVID patients as well. And so really, you know, we're not prone to sending letters, you know, publicly like that. We do try to affect public policy in a lot of different ways, but the situation has gotten to a point where we really need a unified, to the greatest extent possible, a unified response for the state of Wisconsin. And the place where that is playing out right now is in our state capitol, between the governor and our legislative leaders.
Have you gotten any kind of response to your letter, either directly addressing these things or in what you've seen from the governor and lawmakers over the last few days?
Well, you know, we're hopeful. We're very cautiously optimistic. So if you think about it, starting week before last, I think it was, the governor had given a speech televised across the state. And I thought the tone of that was very positive and really not partisan. And I thought that was the right thing that was needed at that time, even though COVID has really been kind of a partisan issue. And then that was responded to by Speaker Robin Voss in an equally sort of collaborative tone and desire. And so they have met. I believe they're continuing to have conversations, you know, conversations, action does not necessarily yield. But having said that, you know, this is better than it's been over the last several months. I'd like to think that our letter and our call for action has spurred or added to some of the conciliatory tones. Because that's really what we need right now. We need to set aside partisan differences to the greatest extent possible. I know how difficult that is to do. I've been in this business for a long time, and I appreciate politics, and I understand the dynamics, and I understand that you know, people have different philosophies and different approaches to policymaking. But I also believe firmly that our elected officials at the end of the day want to do what is best for the state of Wisconsin and its people and its communities. And they may differ on how to get there, but get there, we think they must. And so we are really hoping and trying to affect an outcome that is finding common ground to the greatest extent possible. I really think that, you know, politics, and I understand politics, and it is often a all or nothing game. 90% of the time, you know, or maybe, I don't know what the percentage is, but frequently when it's an all or nothing game, the result is nothing. And nothing is not what Wisconsin needs right now. So we continue to be cautiously optimistic. And I think it's be important that our elected leaders keep talking and find that common ground. And at the end of the day, put some meaningful public policy on the table that can actually be passed and implemented.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Hospital Association's call for urgent legislative action to help slow down the spread of COVID-19 and boost hospitals' capacity, the healthcare system's capacity to deal with the large number of cases. Eric Borgerding is with us, president of the Hospital Association. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from state leaders? What kind of policy changes, if you are in healthcare, if you're working in these hospitals we're talking about, what are you seeing where you work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking about the surge in COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin and the toll it's taking on hospitals and medical facilities around the state. Eric Borgerding is our guest, president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. His organization sent a letter last week to Governor Evers and state legislative leaders urging immediate action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the state's leaders? What kind of message do you want to hear from Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the Assembly and Senate? Call 800-642-1234. And has this affected you in your workplace or in your family? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Jody is with us in Monona. Jody, hi.
Hi. Well, I'd like to see our legislature just work at least for 1 week as hard as all of our health care providers are out there working for people who aren't taking the precautions necessary to keep themselves out of that situation. So I'd really like to see them take this seriously, too.
Jody, thanks a lot for the call. Jody referencing the healthcare workers there, Eric. And we heard in that piece from Rich Kramer the idea that, okay, if you drive by a hospital, you don't see what's going on inside. The people working on inside have a very different upfront perspective on what's happening. How can we convey to the rest of us and the lawmakers what hospital workers are actually going through right now?
Yeah, I heard that story, a really well done story. He's a great reporter. And it's true. Healthcare deals with, you know, crisis situations, maybe on a much smaller scale or in microcosms on a daily basis. And our great healthcare providers and our healthcare leaders are, you know, they're inclined to be calm and handle these types handle crisis situations and emergencies in a very professional way that produces a great outcome. So it doesn't. I never thought of it the way that it was presented in the story, because I deal so much directly with our members and see virtually and verbally into the hospitals and the ICUs and the emergency rooms and the incident command meetings that are taking place every day at hospitals across the state. So I, you know, we see firsthand how really difficult and challenging this all is, but you don't see that from the outside because, you know, of the calm and professional manner in which our great healthcare heroes do their job every day. But, you know, that is something that changing, I believe. The amount of media coverage, not only to the numbers, the data that are on dashboards, but what is the human toll behind that data? And the story that played gave you a glimpse into that, but that's playing out all across the state. And so we're working hard to draw attention to the impact and the toll this is all having on our healthcare system and on individuals and on families. And we're doing that through a coalition that we helped found. We're also doing that by giving our elected officials around the state the opportunity to see into, if you will, and hear directly from those incident command meetings that are going on across the state. No one tells the story and paints the picture of what is going on behind those seemingly placid walls, better hospital walls, than the healthcare heroes that are dealing with this fight every day. And we're doing everything we can to give them a voice and a microphone.
Jody, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jane joins us next, calling from Menominee. Jane, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jane?
What I want to bring up is that recently our legislatures from our area have put out a press release that said people should take every precaution to protect themselves and their family so we can bring down the number of cases and have access to health care. They said we should do it, but they didn't list in the press release, nor when they talk about it, what that is. It's like I think they're afraid to say wearing a mask helps, you know, washing your hands help, 6 feet around apart helps. And I would really like for our legislators to model that. I think finally I saw one picture of Donald Trump coming off the helicopter with a mask on. And I think it's a big deal. I think it's necessary for those people to role model what they're suggesting, even though they actually didn't tell us. They just said do it, but didn't tell us what to do.
Jane, thanks a lot for the call. Can you talk, Eric, about the kind of things you're hoping people do in their daily lives to fill out that message that Jane was looking for in order, in part, to take the strain off of hospitals now?
Yeah, I think it's we co-founded a coalition a couple months ago now of now over 100 organizations, and really from all sort of walks of life, if you will, as it relates to industry. So, you know, the Restaurant Association, the Grocers Association, the Counties Association, numerous chambers of commerce across the state, the State Chamber of Commerce. You can go to our website at wha.org and learn more about that coalition. But the point is, you know, there's a lot of noise and differing opinions. This is unfortunately a political issue, which is part of the challenge around COVID from a public policy perspective is how political it is. However, like I said earlier, our priority, the priority of the Wisconsin Hospital Association and the work we do as it relates to helping craft and implement public policy ultimately is really focusing on where we can find that common ground. You know, all or nothing, as I already said, typically yields nothing in politics. So having said all that, we've been focusing really on urging the public to do, you know, really some simple things, and not forever, you know, but some simple things that have been proven. And of course, that's argued about, but have been proven to help minimize the spread of COVID. Of course, wear a mask. Of course, you know, wash your hands. Practice social distancing, avoid large gatherings. And of course, you know, there's other things too that get into the politics, like mask mandates and all of that stuff. But we think it's important to find as much common ground where we can and move it forward. And so we've been continuing to focus on those three, four, or five things. The most recent example of that effort, there are actually two really important ones over the weekend. There was a letter signed by, you know, a couple thousand UW Health employees that appeared, I think, just in the Wisconsin State Journal, but may have been others, really just in a positive tone, urging people to take those kinds of steps. And then also this weekend, appearing in a number of editorial pages, was a letter signed by all of Wisconsin's hospital and health system physician leaders, their chief medical officers, really urging the same. So, you know, I understand Jane's point that we can talk about these things so we're blue in the face, but what we really need folks to do, and there have been a lot of people taking these really and adhering to consistently these simple precautions. We just need more to take up that cause and do it for hopefully just a little bit longer. But if we don't see progress in that area, I fear that the spread of COVID will sort of continue in at the pace it has been. And if that's the case, we know that the impact on the healthcare system will also continue to not only where it's been, but will continue to grow.
Eric, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
We've been talking to Eric Borgerding, president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. We talked to him today about the group's call for Governor Evers and the legislature to act immediately to limit the spread of COVID-19 and to help deal with hospitals facing capacity and workforce concerns with a surge of COVID-19 patients. You can keep following the latest news about COVID-19 at WPR.org, our news team keeping on top of everything, and head over to wiscontext.org. They've been doing a great job of looking at the spread of the disease and efforts to try to slow it down and to treat people with it. Again, that's wiscontext.org. Coming up, archaeologists and everyday people alike are sharing what they're finding in Wisconsin through a Facebook group. We'll talk with one of the group's administrators about what they've unearthed in the ground beneath our feet. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, volunteers in Madison are learning about the legal system by acting as court watchers. We'll talk with the head of the program about how it works and what we can learn just by watching a court hearing. Now, more than 3,000 professional and amateur archaeologists make up the Wisconsin Archaeological Artifacts Facebook group. Group members can post pictures of items they find in Wisconsin on private land and ask about what, if any, historic or Native American significance they might have. J.P. Piotta is one of the group's administrators. J.P., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great privilege.
Can you talk about the origins of this Facebook group a little bit?
Certainly. A well-known authority, Wisconsin Archaeological Resource and Information, Ryan Howell, championed this social media presence about in 2014. And had since begun outreach amongst other archaeological pages, other sorts of different pages revolving around Native American history with context to, you know, the artifacts that are left behind. So that's really where it got its roots.
And JP, when did you first get interested in archaeology and what's going on in Wisconsin?
Certainly. I was about 12 years old, and my dad came home after walking a field from our family field, and he found an arrowhead, and he said, "Hey, like, I just found this walking the dog." Like, I thought it was so cool. I had an idea of what it was, but I really didn't quite know what was out there and where it was. So I got my boots on, and I, you know, spent the first few days searching, and then finally I found my first one, and it just grew and just blew up for me right after that. And it's been a passion ever since.
Well, I scanned through the Facebook page for the group. And what I love is, you know, I might pick up something like that and just think arrowhead. But then people post this and then we got a lot more context and information. What kind of things are people learning by joining in the conversation here?
Oh, it's definitely so interesting. See, the breadth of Wisconsin archaeology and history spans more than just a couple hundred years that we, or some people often mistake. I mean, there was inhabitants of this great state going back 12,000 years ago. So we have the pre-contact period going all the way back to 12,000 plus years when there was still a glacial coverage of the state, all the way up until fur trade and contact times, as they describe them, where we had European fur traders and missionaries, among other different types of interested parties of this great land that had arrived on the shores of Lake Michigan and other waterways. And, you know, it goes between what you're able to find, the context or significance of maybe just something you find, but just information in your area relating to earthworks, such as built up Native American Indian mounds that are preserved on parks and special sites. It really brings essentially the weight of the sacredness to those areas. And then, you know, it's just another supplemental opportunity for those outside of learning about it in school or wherever books you may pick up along the way. So it's really great.
I know there are some actual professional archaeologists on the group or in the group, and a lot of people who aren't. Can you just talk about the mix of people who are participating in this?
Absolutely. This page really capitalizes on bridging the gap between the professional archaeologists, authorities like professors and other major players in this realm of information space. And then it also bridges the gap to the everyday, not specific to a discipline in archaeology or history. And it makes it really approachable. It allows people to kind of come out in an approachable way, talk and advocate and share some of the memories they can be or finds or information that they may have. And it's really great. And oftentimes there's some hesitancy there just for their sake of a lack of a medium to bring out this information or, just maybe bad experiences in the past. It's a multitude of different things, but really it's a really easily, easy to approach. It's easy to get to. And there's like almost no barrier of entry. We accept everyone. And it's just free domain to speak and share your interest amongst these types of topics.
Talking to JP Piotta, an administrator for the Wisconsin Archaeological Artifacts Facebook group. And speaking, JP, of bridging communities, I understand that there are non-Native origin people in the group and Native Americans in the Wisconsin area as well participating. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. We are privileged again to have those of Native descent, both locally and then outside the state, participate in our group, share their stories, share some insights, and just bring a real wealth of knowledge base. And again, it's just really an honor to be able to have some more exposure to some of those individuals that do join the page, do participate in the page. And it's really fantastic. We are able to not only advocate for a lot of the information that they have for non-natives, but also for other things as well, like events going on that are opportunities for us to better understand culturally some of the context that goes along with being a member of a Native tribe or a Native community in the state.
And there are some do's and don'ts that I learned scanning through the page. Like I specified earlier, things people find on private land. There are laws about collecting things, for example, on public land. What kind of things do we need to know if we want to be, I guess, amateur archaeologists ourselves?
Absolutely. That's a great question. One of the key rules here is, abide by all state and federal regulations and laws. It is a big, big no-no to knowingly go on state or federal lands or lands that are not essentially yours or private and, be intrusive in a way where you're digging, breaking ground, uncovering any types of terrain associated with the artifacts as they would be in situ, which is like the text or way to describe how things lay. Now, that is a big rule. It's fairly clearly advocated across multiple different types of literature from the Wisconsin DNR. There's a few other areas across the state that goes into just the civil law of that. But, politics is another thing we discuss. We are neutral. We don't like talking about politics, and we also don't do buy-sell trade. I mean, that is a very big revenue stream for some people. Believe it or not, it's unfortunate, but people will sell their personal finds. It loses context. Sometimes it's out of state. We are not in that business. There are several pages across social media and the internet where they're just dedicated to selling these. And we're really not about that. We want to make sure that people know that our priority, that our line of sight and our target is just advocacy, bringing enthusiasts, bringing those that are passionate about our state's historical resources, archaeological resources, you know, together. There's no type of commerce associated with that. And you know, that's really the great thing. And that's probably one of the other big rules that we follow here on the page as well.
And you mentioned earthworks earlier, and I know that's a point of focus for some people on the group, what we often call mounds here in the state, a lot of them destroyed over the years. This is something that I think a lot of people who are part of this archaeological artifacts group are concerned with.
Absolutely, and rightfully so. Wisconsin, out of all the states in North America, is uniquely gifted with these resources, and it's very unique. There's seldom even close to the amount and volume of these earthworks in any other state. It's really incredible. And these earthworks stem several thousand years old. And unfortunately, early habitation of the state didn't have as stringent laws, rules, and protections against some of these great resources. So as time progressed, as we had a better understanding, as we got legislation and key leadership involved over from local government officials all the way up to the you know, the federal government, we're able to preserve what we do have left. And fortunately for us and those who are alive today, we still have a great amount of these resources for those to have on public display, and then obviously preserve and protect them. And believe it or not, and I can speak from my own experience, I too have come across undocumented earthworks as well that I was able to use this page and the professionals on this page to document it and catalog it as required. So that has happened on a few occasions, but, you know, again, it's protecting this unique resource to the state. So it's great. It's really great.
JP, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And I really do appreciate the outreach and opportunity to grow the page. Thank you.
JP Piotta is an administrator for the Wisconsin Archaeological Artifacts Facebook group. We talked to him today about what members of the group are finding around Wisconsin, sometimes as close as their own backyards. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a very good girl.
The Mequon Nature Preserve, north of Milwaukee, is home to Wisconsin's first conservation dog, Tilia. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently traveled there to learn how they're harnessing Tilia's powerful sense of smell to reach their conservation goals.
That sniffing you hear is Tilia, the conservation dog at Mequon Nature Preserve. Right now, she's looking for a treat. But when she's on the job, she'll be sniffing out wild parsnip or salamanders.
There you go. Good girl.
What exactly is a conservation dog, you might ask? Tilia's main job is to detect both invasive and endangered species at the nature preserve. The staff then comes in and removes those invasive species, like the wild parsnip, and monitors for the endangered ones, like the salamanders. Corey Gritzmacher is the director of operations at the nature preserve. He says Tilia is far better at it than even the highest trained human professionals. Canines can be up to 40 times more efficient than people.
Sometimes the best trained volunteers or staff in the world won't even be able to find what, you know, a canine can. So that's the pretty impressive part about it. And who doesn't want to go to work with a dog?
Just who's in charge is up for debate.
I often joke, you know, it's not necessarily us getting trained. It's kind of them training us. You know, like, this is what you have to do if you want me to do something for you. Right? Yeah. Yes. You always have a lot to say.
Tilia is highly motivated by food. Or by toys. Gritzmacher says being motivated is the key to being a good conservation dog.
Dogs in general already have 200 million olfactory sensors. We have about 5 million. So they're already set up and designed for scent detection. It's really just finding a dog that's motivated and wants to do it on a regular basis and is excited to do it, right?
4 years old now, Tilia began training as a puppy. It was slow at the start, with treats hidden in cardboard boxes. Then it got progressively more challenging until she graduated to what Gritzmacher calls pairing. That's when he places scent samples in a salt shaker. They're much more appealing with a treat sitting on top.
Eventually, we'd start taking the treat away, and then as she continues to hit on the correct sample, then she gets rewarded. So she's going to get paid again. You know, it's kind of the same thing. You know, we do our work, we get paid. She does her work, she gets paid.
The day I visited, Tilia's excitement was clear. With her vest on, she knew what was happening. Gritzmacher had hidden treats to mimic a search on the prairie for parsnip or salamanders.
She's got a release word. That's kind of her cue to go, we're going to go search and find something. So, and you're pretty excited to do this today, aren't you? So you got to go back down to sit. Good girl. All right.
Twinkie.
It's kind of a little bit of a mind game and an obstacle course for her to work through.
While Tilia's nose is the star, when it comes down to it, the success of the endeavor is as much about the rapport and relationship between the dog and the trainer. If Gritzmacher hadn't trained Tilia, he wouldn't be able to pick up on her subtle body cues, like if she gets distracted by a deer or rabbit and veers off course.
And this is the part where you start training me, right? Yeah, yeah.
Using dogs for conservation work is the same idea as police or search and rescue dogs. While Tilia was the only conservation dog in the state for several years, she now has company, and Gritzmacher only expects that number to grow.
Canines are going to start to play a huge role in the conservation field just because of their amazing detection skills, especially when resources are limited, staff is limited, and you have to search, you know, potentially thousands of acres or miles of shoreline or whatever.
It's tough work for her. Gritzmacher says she gets worn out from a long day at work just like we do. Tilia's owner is the director of the Mequon Nature Preserve. At the end of the day, she gets to go home, be the family dog, and take some well-deserved time off.
Do you agree? Okay, good.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Tilia, the conservation dog. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll hear about a Madison group that's helping people learn about the legal system as court watchers. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 60 million Americans say they often feel lonely, and the numbers have gotten worse this year. One possible solution may come from across the pond. Jen White meets the UK's Minister of Loneliness today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a lot of us like to watch the occasional legal drama or courtroom TV show, but to really understand the legal system, there's no substitute for watching the real thing. Since 2018, a Madison program has been helping people do exactly that. The Justified Anger Coalition and Nehemiah Center have been training volunteers as court observers. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, virtual court proceedings have meant there's more of a chance to watch how court hearings actually work. Karen Reese is Vice President of Research and Education at the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development in Madison. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This started, as I said, in 2018. Can you talk about the inspiration for training people to be court watchers?
Sure. This really developed out of a comment from a Dane County Circuit Court judge who mentioned that they don't usually see many supporters for criminal defendants in the courtroom, and that it really made a difference when he did see people supporting the defendant in the courtroom. And so we wanted to find a way to work on that more. A group of volunteers came together that wanted to learn more about the criminal justice system and ways to advocate for people in the courtroom, and the observation program developed out of that.
What goes into the training?
Part of the training is simply just observing courtroom proceedings. So one of the best ways to learn about how our criminal justice system actually works is to sit in the courtroom, or these days watch it on YouTube and learn about how it operates. But we also have various volunteers who've been doing this for 2 years, as well as some people involved in the legal system who have put together a detailed training opportunity that teaches people about the ins and outs of the system and some terms and definitions and everything that a person needs to know to do this volunteering role.
When people think of courts, I think the first word that might pop in their head is trials. But as I understand it, that's mostly not what happens in courtrooms and mostly not what these volunteers are watching. What are they seeing instead?
That's right. Yeah, less than 5% of all cases actually go to trial. Most of our cases are settled by plea bargain, or some cases are also dismissed. So when people are watching these proceedings, they're seeing a lot of different things. Sometimes they're seeing an initial appearance, and that's after a person is charged. They go to their first appearance before a judge to determine the charges that are being brought against them. They also hear general hearings that will go over the details of the case, preliminary hearings, And then it's quite common to witness a sentencing hearing where after a judgment has been entered, the individual will come back before the judge and hear what their sentence will be, whether they're going to be on probation or sentenced to jail or prison.
And the idea here, as I understand it, Karen, isn't just, you know, the observer comes away knowing more about the legal system, but they also make observations and take notes. And in some cases, that ends up getting back to judges and other people involved in the legal system. What kind of things have come out of this?
That's right. So one of the biggest reasons for observers to be there is, first and foremost, to just bear witness to the court process, make sure that things are operating the way they're supposed to and in the spirit that our criminal justice system was meant to operate. Some of the things that we've noticed is during the in-person initial appearance court, it was difficult to hear. So that presented an opportunity for volunteers to contact court officials and let them know that they may need to troubleshoot this. One other striking thing is that in the over 500 cases that volunteers have observed, we've noticed that the average hearing length is actually less than 15 minutes. But this is a situation that has a huge impact, sometimes a life-changing impact for people. And so to think that it's decided on the record in less than 15 minutes is pretty impactful. Other thing that comes out of this is recommending areas of advocacy that Nehemiah and other groups can take to make sure that people who are going through the process have what they need to be successful.
Yeah, talk about that. What kind of advocacy have you taken out of these observations?
A few different things. So there have been some cases where we've noticed people that may need some extra help, and then we've been able to let our Nehemiah staff who work in the areas of reentry, so people coming to the community after jail and prison, to assist in that way. We've also been able to take the observation. So the volunteers fill out a pretty detailed observation sheet. And this data was then able to be used by a UW sociology course of undergrads who are looking to observe the impact of COVID on the court process. So are people's cases, how long are they taking? Are they being dragged out for a period of time? Are people who were sentenced to jail actually in the community for a period of time while they wait for it to be safe to go into jail? So kind of looking into all of these complexities.
And this started with people actually going and observing in courtrooms. What is the experience like for people now with the pandemic observing remotely these remote hearings?
Well, everything is online now, and it took us a few months to kind of get used to this and realize that this was something that was going to be here to stay for a while. Right now, if you look up in court records, there will be a YouTube link to each judge's courtroom. And so when court proceedings are taking place, our volunteers now, instead of arranging their day, finding parking downtown, can just sit in front of their computers or their phones, hit the YouTube link and pull up the hearing. And you can't hear, the judges can't hear people who are observing. This process is entirely open to the public. And so they can sit and observe at any point that's convenient for them during the day.
This is in the Madison area, your program. If people in other communities are listening and thinking, yeah, we need something like this here, what did it take to get started?
It really just took a handful of dedicated volunteers who wanted to get this started. Or, Nehemiah is an active community group. If there's a community group that'd be interested, we would be very interested in sharing how we got this started. People are more than welcome to contact us. And they can just email volunteer@nehemiah.org. That's NEHEMIAH.org. And we can take it from there.
As we wrap up, I'm curious, Karen, what has been the response from judges knowing that they have these court watchers starting to show up in person or now online?
It's been pretty amazing. We weren't really sure what to expect, but as volunteers began to show up regularly in courtrooms, we really did get the attention from the judges on the bench who would come after the hearings and ask what people were up to, not in a judgmental way, but just to learn and understand. And since then, judges have been very eager to have conversations with their volunteers, to have a dialogue back and forth about the process. And we've also had conversations with public defender's office, with DAs, and even some of the bailiffs who do a lot of the operational things that happen in the courtroom. So it's really created this relationship between our organization, volunteers, and people who are doing the day in and day out of our court process.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Karen Reese is Vice President of Research and Education at the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development in Madison. She talked to us about the group's Court Observer Program, which helps people learn about the legal system and find opportunities to advocate for changes in that system by watching court proceedings firsthand, either in person when we're not having a pandemic or now online. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at a new federal report showing a rise in hate crimes last year. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news. Then, the Trump administration has set a timetable to remove more American troops from Afghanistan. We'll get the latest on that move. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.